All right, so this is Bible 241, and it is Wednesday, October 1st, and we're going to start a new chapter, and that's chapter 7, but don't forget, next time, we have a test in class, so we'll finish up this chapter maybe a week from today. Yeah, so question. So this chapter is not on the exam. Yeah, so it's only 4, 5, and 6. Okay, chapters 4, 5, and 6. So do you have any questions on chapters 4, 5, or 6? The hardest one is probably 5, is my guess. The last one we did, which is chapter 5. Okay, so you got to know metabolism. What are the four main metabolic pathways or four main reactions involved with aerobic respiration? Glycolysis, number one. The starts with a P. How does something get into the Krebs cycle? It's via the, it's the preparatory reaction. So the Krebs, I'm sorry, glycolysis, the preparatory reaction, and then Krebs cycle, and then electron transport. And the preparatory reaction is just a really small reaction that converts pyruvate into acetyl-CoA. And then that acetyl-CoA is donated to the Krebs cycle. Okay. All right, and you should know, where does substrate level phosphorylation take place? Substrate level. What? Substrate level phosphorylation. What's another way that ADP can be phosphorylated besides substrate level phosphorylation? Oxidative phosphorylation. So let's start with oxidative phosphorylation. Where does oxidative phosphorylation take place? A metabolic pathway in what part of the cell? Electron transport chain is the answer. And where is that located? In the mitochondria. What about substrate level phosphorylation? Glycolysis and also the Krebs cycle. And where does glycolysis take place? In the cytoplasm or cytosol, and where does the Krebs cycle take place? Yeah, in the matrix of the mitochondria, the innermost space of the mitochondria. Yeah, that's oxidative phosphorylation. What's the theory that explains oxidative phosphorylation? The chemiosmotic theory. What kind of gradient is used to generate ATP? Yeah, proton gradient, that's right, a hydrogen ion gradient across the Christi membrane of the mitochondria. What molecule is necessary to keep electron transport open and operating? Oxygen. What's the last molecule made by the electron transport chain?
Water.
So hopefully it should be getting a little bit easy, or right now, okay? Okay, and then don't forget glucose. You should be able to take glucose and make glycogen out of it and know what that term is called. You should be able to make glucose from glycogen and know what that pathway is called. Okay, and going from glucose to pyruvate, you know what that's called. What about pyruvate going back up to glucose, what's that called? That's gluconeogenesis, right? Okay, so those are some of the things from that chapter. Okay. Well, if you don't have any more questions for me, I'm going to get started talking about Chapter 7, which is nervous system, nervous tissue. Okay, so can you all see the board? Maybe I can turn some of these lights down a little bit, like maybe this one? That one is good. Ah, that one's even better, I think. Okay. But don't fall asleep. Okay, so we're going to talk a little bit. This is just going to be a really quick review over what you already know from an anatomy class, the different kinds of cells that we see in nervous tissue. All right, and those are neurons and neuroglia cells. And we're going to get into the membrane potential once again and talk about an action potential, which is different than a resting membrane potential, because during a resting membrane potential, nothing is changing. But in a living cell, things change all the time. These cells are excitable, and that produces an action potential. So what's happening during an action potential? That's the first term. Action potential means there's some action involved. All right, some things are changing in the voltage. And we're going to then talk about synaptic transmission and some neurotransmitters and synaptic integration. All right, so don't forget, nervous system is divided into two main categories, central nervous system and the peripheral nervous system. Furthermore, the CNS can be broken down into the brain and spinal cord. You should know that. And it's surrounded by the meninges, right? Then the peripheral nervous system is everything outside the central nervous system. And that includes both the cranial nerves and spinal nerves. Where do cranial nerves come from? The brain, that's right. And spinal nerves come from the spine. So that's actually pretty easy stuff to know. All right, so you might want to go back and just look at the overall architecture of the nervous system. Okay, know the autonomic nervous system and the motor nervous system and the sensory, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All right, so also there are two different kinds of cells that make up nervous tissue, and those are neurons, and the other kind are what we call supporting cells. These are what we call neuroglia or neural glial cells. Neurons are specialized to conduct electrical information. They carry electrical impulses or nerve impulses. Neuroglia, on the other hand, don't carry electrical impulses, but they support what the neurons are doing. And we're going to look at some different kinds of neuroglia cells and what their specific functions are. So for many, many, many years, people were not interested in neuroglia because they didn't carry electrical signals. They didn't think their job was very important. And now recently, people are really interested in neuroglia cells, and I'll describe why later on in the lecture. Okay, so the neurons still, though, are considered the functional units of the nervous system because they transmit information over long distances in your body and very, 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 very quickly. All right, glial cells maintain the homeostasis of the nervous system. And there are five times more glial cells than there are neurons. So you have many, many more different kinds of support cells than you do neurons. All right, so let's look at a neuron. They gather information and transmit that information by responding to stimuli. So what does anything have to have in order for it to be sensitive to a stimulus? It has to have some kind of receptor for it, right? Okay. And once that receptor is stimulated, a neuron can produce and it sends these electrochemical impulses over the whole length of a cell. And a neuron, of course, is microscopic. You can't see it with your naked eye, but some of them can be tremendously long. Some of them can be a meter long, but they're still what? Microscopically thin, so you can't still see them. But nonetheless, these cells are very long. So a neuron is a cell, not really a nerve. Okay, a nerve will be an accumulation, maybe thousands or tens of thousands of neurons that are going someplace in your peripheral nervous system. And when that electrical message reaches the end of a nerve, that nerve releases a chemical messenger, which we call a neurotransmitter. Okay, so here we have a typical view of what a neuron looks like. They have a cell body, they have dendrites and axons, so the cell body is where the nucleus resides. It's like the center of mass of this cell. That's where the rough endoplasmic reticulum for synthesis of proteins takes place. And it's loaded with mitochondria. This is the part of the cell that can make neurotransmitter. And then these smaller processes right here are what we call dendrites. Dendrites are the receiving part of a neuron. So they receive signals from other neurons, or they might actually receive signals from receptor cells that are sensitive to particular stimuli. And a dendrite, because it's the receiving end of the cell, has something called ligand-gated channels in it. So you might want to just write that down on your slide, a ligand-gated channel. That means that these are proteins within the membrane that are normally closed, but when they bind a signaling molecule, That's what we call a ligand, like maybe a neurotransmitter. That channel opens up, and it's going to allow for the diffusion of maybe sodium or potassium to either enter or leave the cell. So dendrites have ligand-gated channels, and even the cell body might have some ligand-gated channels. Okay, so that's the cell body. Another name for the cell body is a soma. Soma means body. So this is the soma of a neuron. And then this very long process right here is an axon. Typically, we don't find, at least our current level of understanding, we don't have any ligand-gated channels that change the electricity of an axon. They're different. Right about in this region right here, this axon hillock, right? This is what we call the trigger zone on a neuron. The kinds of receptors change from ligand-gated channels to voltage-gated channels. And so the nature of the chemical properties of a neuron changes because these channels change their characteristics, right? And they change the characteristics right here within the axon hillock. And in this chapter, we'll learn of what these differences are between a ligand-gated channel and a voltage-gated channel. Okay, so since we have voltage-gated channels along this axon right here, this is what we call the sending part of the neuron. So the receiving part is the dendrite and soma, or cell body. The sending part is the axon, all the way down to the axon terminus. All right, and notice that a neuron is always a one-way street. Electrical impulses always go from dendrites to the cell body down an axon. Electrical signals can't go backwards in a neuron. Oops, let's go back. All right, so anybody know what kind of neuron this is by its shape? Probably going to have to look that up. That's what we call a multipolar neuron. Okay, a multipolar. You've got books of these. All right, so this is typical of a nice motor neuron. So the cell body right here you would find in the central nervous system, and it would leave the central nervous system via this axon and go to some kind of effector organ. Well, this neuron right here is typical of a sensory organ. So these are the dendrites in some peripheral part of your body, so we call this the peripheral process. The cell body you would find in the dorsal root ganglia, right, of the entrance to the spinal cord, and then this is the central process, or what we call the axon, entering the central nervous system. Okay, so what kind of neuron does this look like? Anybody remember? This is a... It's not multipolar, because that's this one here. This is a unipolar neuron, right? And so unipolar is always going to be a sensory neuron. And again, electrical information cannot flow from the axon out of the central nervous system down the peripheral process to a dendrite. It always goes one way. Okay. So the cell body is the nutritional center, and it makes macromolecules like neurotransmitters. Groups of cell bodies are always going to be located together. They're going to clump together. In the central nervous system, a group of nerve cell bodies is called a nucleus. It used to be called a ganglia, like the basal ganglia in the brain, but a more modern term for it would be a nucleus. So in the brain, a nucleus is going to look gray because it's just a group of nerve cell bodies and dendrites. And if you just have neurons without myelin around them, they look gray, right? And so that's what a nucleus is. It's going to look gray because there's no myelin. But the axons are myelinated because of these Schwann cells that are wrapping myelin around an axon. These axons then will take the characteristic of that myelin, which is a lipid compound, and they're going to look white. So any place where you have tracts in the central nervous system, which are groups of axons going someplace, and they're myelinated, then that's going to produce white matter in the central nervous system. Okay. And also, in the peripheral nervous system, the cell bodies or the soma of neurons are going to clump together. So for these sensory neurons, right, all of these cell bodies will be located at the entrance to the central nervous system. So how in the spinal region, How do signals enter the spinal cord? Remember, there are two routes to the spinal cord. Is that kind of ringing a bell? What are the two routes? There's the dorsal root and the ventral root. Which one is motor and which one is sensory? The dorsal is always going to be sensory and the ventral is going to be motor. So since this is a sensory neuron, these cell bodies are going to be in what? The dorsal root ganglia. So that's what the dorsal root ganglia is made of. It's just an accumulation of all these nerve cell bodies of these unipolar neurons. Okay? And if there's a group of these nerve cell bodies in the peripheral nervous system, we call it a ganglia. So what's the big difference between a nucleus and a ganglia? It's just the location. Nucleus is central nervous system. Ganglia is peripheral nervous system. Okay, so dendrites receive information. How is it that a dendrite can receive information? What's a membrane protein that allows them to receive information? They have a ligand-gated channel. Okay, axons conduct impulses away from the cell body. And they can conduct impulses away because they have voltage-gated channels. And I'm not sure you know what that means just yet, but we got to start using the terminology sooner or later. So you'll start to see what happens. All right, so let's get away from electrical impulses for the moment and then just talk about different transport systems that can move macromolecules along that whole big length of an axon. We call that axoplasmic flow, right? It moves soluble compounds toward the nerve endings, toward the axon terminus. And this is due to rhythmic contractions of the axon. So the axons actually have like peristalsis that squishes fluid down toward the axon terminus. Of course, that's very slow, much slower than a nerve impulse. But this is good for movement of materials down the axon. Right, as opposed to axonal transport, moves large and insoluble compounds, even bidirectionally up and down the axon, and it uses that little monorail system that the cell uses to move organelles around inside the cell body. And that what do we call that monorail system? Those are the microtubules. Right, so different particles can hop a ride on the microtubules. Antegrade transmission moves materials away from the cell body. So antegrade means from the cell body down the axon. So there are microtubules that move things in this direction and also the reverse direction as well. All right, but this is a very slow process. The reverse direction is what we call anterograde. Retrograde. Antegrade goes from the cell body to the axon. That's antegrade. That's the forward direction. Retrograde means just backwards. Okay, so for instance, even in the circulatory system, sometimes blood flows out of your heart to your tissues. We call that antegrade flow. Sometimes blood actually flows backwards in an artery under certain circumstances. That is what we call retrograde. So retrograde just means backwards. So I don't like to use that term backwards too often. Right, the antegrade flow uses a molecule called kinesin, but the retrograde flow is due to a different kind of motor protein, which we call dynein. Right, so dynein molecules move things retrograde, and this might be a way that some viruses and toxins even can enter the central nervous system by hopping on a dynein molecule and move from a peripheral process all the way, okay, into the central nervous system through retrograde flow. All right, and functional classification of neurons. I think you probably have a feel of this from anatomy already. Sensory is the same thing as afferent, right? And motor is the same thing as efferent. But we usually say afferent and efferent when we're speaking, but in a large class like this with echoes and things like that, I mispronounce the words a little bit so that you can understand it a little bit better. So I say afferent and efferent so you can clearly hear what I'm saying. All right, so an afferent neuron takes signals from the periphery to the central nervous system, like via this unipolar neuron right here. A motor neuron carries signals from the central nervous system to the periphery. Okay, so those are two kinds of neurons, sensory versus motor, or afferent versus efferent. And then every once in a while, we have neurons that are completely found within the central nervous system. So far, these sensory neurons, you see part in the peripheral, part in the central nervous system. And a motor neuron, part of it is in the central nervous system, part of it is in the peripheral nervous system. But there's one kind of neuron that is contained completely within the central nervous system, and that's what we call an association neuron. And association neurons integrate information, gather information from various places, and decide what to do with that information. Maybe it will stimulate a motor neuron, or maybe it won't, depending on what the decision of that association neuron is. Okay, so they're located completely within the central nervous system. Some motor neurons or some motor pathways only require one neuron to go all the way from the central nervous system to the effector. And in that particular case, that would be a somatic motor neuron. And when we use that term somatic, we just mean voluntary. So it is a neuron that is voluntarily controlled by your consciousness. So what kind of effectors do you have conscious control over in your body? Okay, skeletal muscle is one. What else? You're thinking. And that's good, you're stumped, because you know what? There is nothing else that you can control voluntarily in your body, only skeletal muscle. So skeletal muscle is the only thing that you have conscious control of. Right? And so when we say voluntary conscious control, that is somatic motor. Right? That just takes one neuron. Everything else is what we call autonomic, which is just a fancy term for what? Automatic. Things take care of themselves automatically. So what parts of your body take care of themselves automatically? Your heart, cardiac muscle, number one. Smooth muscle, number two. And one last thing. Is it on the slide? Oh, it says right there. And glands, that's right. Okay, you can trick yourself to, regulate your heart rate a little bit. Okay, like I could say, all right, put your notes away. Instead of having the test on Monday, we're going to take the test now and get it over with before the weekend. Okay, so what happened to your heart rate? It just went up, right? So you can trick your heart into doing different things, but that's not really having conscious control over it, right? Okay. Maybe you started sweating from glands too when I said that. But you can't really stop your glands from secreting or make them secrete, right, just by willing it to happen. These things take care of themselves. Okay. All right, so here are the types of neurons. You got the multipolar. These are a good example would be a motor neuron. The unipolar, your book calls them pseudo-unipolar, because they bifurcate after this one process comes off of the soma of the body. So pseudo-unipolar or unipolar from sensory neurons. And then bipolar neurons look like this, where you have dendrites, right, and two processes, but only one is an axonal process. These are what we find in various sense organs, like in the nose and the eye. So only in a few limited locations in our body do we have true bipolar neurons. Right, and these are always going to be involved with sensation of some kind, special sensory organs. All right, so let's talk about, so we talked a little bit about neurons. There's a receiving part, a sending part, the different kinds of functions, right? They can be afferent or efferent, or they can be association neurons. So the support cells. With this motor neuron right here, there are different ways that this motor neuron can send an impulse down this axon. It can be relatively slow or it can be relatively fast, depending on what kind of glial cells are associated with the axon. And so the axon is in this, what does that look like to you? Like yellow? It's a nice yellow color. Okay, so the axon is yellow, but I see like a beige or something right here. Okay. The beige is from the neuroglial cell, and in particular, this is a Schwann cell. And Don't forget, a motor neuron sends this axon into the peripheral part of your body, out of the central nervous system. So this axon is in the peripheral part of your nervous system. So these Schwann cells are found in the peripheral nervous system, not in the central nervous system. And they secrete a lipid kind of compound, which is called myelin. And myelin acts as an insulator. It prevents electrical currents from leaving the axon in this region right here. So you could think of an axon as being some wire, and the myelin sheath formed in this location right here as acting as insulation that we have, like rubber or plastic around the wire. It just prevents the electricity from hopping out of the axon. And that speeds the rate of conduction of that electrical impulse down the axon. So let's pretend that this axon doesn't have any of these Schwann cells right here and is just a bare, naked axon. If that's the case, then that electrical impulse has to move molecule by molecule right down the axon. I can't even imagine how many molecules make up an axon. You know, trillions of trillions of molecules, right? So it's a very complicated, very long process to get an electrical impulse all the way down the axon. But if it has Schwann cells around it with these myelin sheaths, right, that electrical impulse doesn't have to go from molecule to molecule. It can hop from one end of a Schwann cell to another, or from one node to another node. So the space between Schwann cells is called a node of Ranvier, and so the electrical impulse hops. And as the electrical impulse hops, the speed of conduction is a lot faster. So I suppose you could think of maybe running down a flight of stairs. Maybe not running up a flight of stairs, but say running down a flight of stairs. I could run up and down flights of stairs when I was in high school, but not anymore. Okay. So let's run down a flight of stairs. What would be faster? Okay. If you were going to run down some stairs and if you had to step on every stair, number one, or number two, when you're running down the stairs, just jump from every third stair. Okay, so skip a couple on the way down. So what would be faster, when you have to step on every single one, or if you could hop from stair to stair? Okay, hopping would be a lot faster. Same thing for electrical impulses, right? If that electrical impulse can hop down the neuron, it's a lot faster. And so when it can hop, we call that saltatory conduction. Saltatory conduction is a lot faster. But if it has to go every single molecule, right, we call that continuous conduction. Continuous conduction is a lot slower. So that's the advantage of having Schwann cells in the peripheral nervous system. Speed of conduction is enhanced. It's faster. Okay. All right, so here, so those are the cells, this last slide over here, are cells of the peripheral nervous system, namely Schwann cells. But there's another kind of cell in the peripheral nervous system that surrounds the cell body. I don't see it on this slide right here. And that just maintains the health of this neuron. Those cells are what we call satellite cells. Okay, and I won't mention any functions of the satellite cells. But a satellite cell are just the neuroglial cells that surround cell bodies in the peripheral nervous system. So you got two kinds of cells in the peripheral nervous system. You got the Schwann cells that make the myelin sheath and the satellite cells. Now in the central nervous system, we've got different kinds of cells. We do see cells that can wrap themselves around an axon. So here is a neuron inside the central nervous system. And this is going to be an association neuron. These are completely within the CNS. And these axons are myelinated. So is this a fast impulse conduction or slow? It's fast. So these cells also enhance the speed of the nerve impulse. But we don't call these Schwann cells. We call these oligodendrocytes. So oligodendrocytes are in the central nervous system. Schwann are in the peripheral nervous system. Their function is the same, but their structure is a lot different. Notice that one oligodendrocyte can myelate a number of different positions along an axon and even different neurons. And we might actually be learning more about these oligodendrocytes in the next coming years because maybe these bridges between neurons actually mean something. But at the moment, we just don't know. Okay, and we don't see this kind of architecture in the peripheral nervous system. But can you tell the difference between a Schwann cell and an oligodendrocyte very easily? because the oligodendrocyte has these numerous processes and numerous areas for of myelination around an axon. But the Schwann cell is just completely contained in one area of an axon. Okay. All right, another kind of cell is an astrocyte right here. And it was named because when they first started looking at these underneath the microscope, it kind of looked like a star pattern with light rays coming out of it, all these different processes. And astrocytes are between, usually found between a capillary right here and a neuron. And this astrocyte can act like a bridge, can actively take up things that this neuron needs, like for instance glucose, can actively take up glucose, transport it through the cell, and release it to this neuron. So it acts like a bridge for glucose. Neurons communicate with each other via neurotransmitters, chemical compounds, and astrocytes can regulate neurotransmitters as well, which means that it can regulate communication between two neurons. And also, not everything that's in this capillary can diffuse out of the capillary within the brain. Most capillaries are very leaky. They have holes in them, so fluid will leak out. But the brain is very special because it has to maintain a high degree of metabolism even when you're sleeping. Okay, so even when you're asleep, your brain is very, very active because it's controlling what? Even when you're sleeping. Everything except your skeletal muscles. And I suppose even if you're dreaming, your brain is controlling your skeletal muscles. So all the other parts of your body don't fall asleep when you do. The brain still has to keep track of everything, so it's highly metabolic. Okay, so things in the blood can be very toxic to the brain. And so these astrocytes form what we call the blood-brain barrier. So it protects the brain from everything that's in the circulatory system. Very few things can move across the blood-brain barrier. And that just protects the metabolism of the brain because it's just so crucial. And whenever you want to deliver a drug to the brain, for instance, that blood-brain barrier can be a problem, can be a pharmacologic problem because you have to design a drug that can do what? Can get across the blood-brain barrier. And sometimes it's a really difficult job to engineer a drug that you want to have an effect on these neurons, but it can't get across the blood-brain barrier. It has to be modified somehow so that it can diffuse across. So the job of the astrocyte also is to help make that blood-brain barrier that under most circumstances protects your brain. All right, then we have some immune cells. And those are the microglia right here. These are almost like white blood cells that are crawling around inside your brain all the time, looking for bacteria and viruses and damaged cells and even tumors to some degree. Okay, they can fight tumors. And then the last kind of cell are the ependymal cells. Right, so the oligodendrocyte, the microglia, the astrocyte, and these ependymal cells, they're all nervous tissue, but they're just not neurons. They don't conduct electrical information. The ependymal cells line every cavity inside the brain, so there is a lining. It's almost like an epithelium, but this is nervous tissue. What are some of the names of cavities inside your brain from anatomy? Ooh, blast to the past. That is what? What kind of cavities do you have in your brain? What's in those cavities? There's something in there. Okay, there's fluid, and as a matter of fact, there's some sinuses in your brain that have blood in them, but I was actually thinking of the cavities that don't have blood in them, that have the fluid. What's the name of that fluid? Like cerebral spinal fluid, CSF, in the ventricles of the brain. The cavities are called ventricles. Remember the lateral ventricles, and then the third ventricle, and then the fourth ventricle down over here. And that fluid flows through all the different ventricles down through the central canal of the spinal cord, all the way down to the conus medullaris and then up through the subarachnoid space. Well, so you have that flow of cerebral spinal fluid. These ependymal cells also help make cerebral spinal fluid. So in certain places, like the roof of the fourth ventricle and the roof of the third ventricle, these ependymal cells are highly vascularized. So a highly vascularized group of ependymal cells that make cerebral spinal fluid is called, what is it called? That's another anatomy type question. It's called the, two words, choroid plexus. The choroid plexus, so these ependymal cells make the choroid plexus, which makes cerebral spinal fluid, for instance. Okay, so these are the functions of the neuroglia cells, and I don't know, I think this might be an exam figure. Okay, I can't remember if it is or not, but if it is, since this is a physiology class, I probably don't want to ask you, oh, what's the name of this cell right here? Ah, but you should know from anatomy. I would ask you what? What's the function of the cell? Just like on that cell diagram, which was a really easy diagram on the first test. Right, when you look at a mitochondria, I didn't ask you what's the name of that organelle. I wanted to know what the function was, right? And now you know a whole lot more about the function of that mitochondria from a biochemical standpoint. Okay, so I want to know the functions of these things. All right, so here is a cell that is wrapping myelin, which we call a myelin sheath, around an axon. So what can you tell me about this picture right here? You can tell me all kinds of things about it, like where is it in your body? It is in the central nervous system, right? Because it's an oligodendrocyte. It's just not a simple Schwann cell. And so what is it doing for these axons right here? Myelin. It is. It's putting myelin around it. But what does that mean? It's making these axons transmit impulses a lot faster, right? It speeds the rate of conduction around them. Okay. Okay, so that's this one right here. Let's see what other kinds of cells. So this is how either a Schwann cell or even an oligodendrocyte, okay, can wrap many, many layers of insulation around an axon. Okay, it starts in one location and actually just wraps itself around. And these layers right here do not have cytoplasm in there. There are no salts, for instance. There's no sodium and potassium because those would conduct electricity. The only thing that you have in these layers right here is myelin, which is an insulating material. And eventually, all of the cytoplasm ends up in the outermost layer of a Schwann cell. And this outermost layer right here that has the cytoplasm and not myelin, that's what we call the neurolemma. So the neurolemma is just kind of pushed out to the outside layer of a Schwann cell. Okay, yeah, don't forget about that note of Ron VA right there. Okay. Axonal regeneration. Well, generally speaking, axons or nerves don't regenerate very well at all. There aren't very many locations where there are stem cells in the nervous system, at least as far as we know. Okay. And I'm not sure we actually know why this is. Right, but oligodendrocytes produce proteins that actually inhibit the regrowth of neurons when they're damaged. And they form a glial scar tissue that blocks the regrowth. And where do we find these oligodendrocytes? In the central nervous system, right? So the central nervous system just does not regenerate at all because of that. Okay. But now in the peripheral nervous system, we don't have oligodendrocytes that inhibit regeneration. We have Schwann cells. And if there is an injury to a nerve, okay, that's going to kill this this distal end of the axon right here, there still is debris from these Schwann cells, and the Schwann cells then will regroup and reform a neural tube, which then guides the growth of the axon from the remaining part of the healthy cell. All right, so we would just call that a growth tube, a regeneration tube. So nerves in the peripheral nervous system can reinnervate different effector organs that are denervated, but in the central nervous system, that just doesn't happen because of the oligodendrocytes. And this is a particularly interesting slide. Actually, it's really, really short, but for years and years and years, we used to think that cells in the central nervous system never replace themselves, could never regenerate under any kinds of conditions. And that's certainly true, for instance, for spinal cord injuries. We don't really know how to regrow that kind of tissue. But there are chemical compounds that we are aware of now called neurotrophins, or neurotropins. And neurotropins we think are primarily secreted by astrocytes in the brain, and they can actually cause your brain to grow. And of course, that's important for fetal nerve growth. But we also now know that that it is very important in the adult brain as well. And I don't know, from anatomy, can you tell me something about your skeletal system? Okay, your bones. Are your bones living tissue or kind of dead tissue, like this concrete column that we have right here in the room, kind of holding up the second floor, third floor, whatever floor that is up there? Okay. Yeah, bones are very much alive, because what kind of cells are in bones? Those are osteocytes, yeah? Osteocytes. And you also have osteoclasts and osteoblasts in some locations. So don't forget, the osteoclasts do what to bone? They break it down. But that's balanced by the cells that build bone up, and those are the osteoblasts, right? So blasts build bone, the clasts break it down, and it's the balance between these two antagonistic cells that maintain the health of your bone. And your bones that you have today, you didn't have any of them 5 years ago. So your complete skeletal system is rebuilt and remanufactured every 5 years. Okay, that's pretty amazing, yeah.
Have you heard of nootropics?
Nootropics? No. Now, is that like a name of a band or something?
No.
You means true or pertaining to you in terms of the brain? That would be wonderful if we know much about those kinds of things. I'm not really up on that, but I certainly would like to know more. Because the analogy that I'm trying to make is that you are completely rebuilding your skeletal system all the time, right? Which is something that you probably have to take a A&P class to realize. All right? But actually, your brain is rebuilding itself all the time. It's not all those neurons aren't turning over as fast as your bones are, but your brain responds to exercise just like muscle responds to exercise and just like bone responds to exercise. How does a muscle respond to exercise? It gets bigger and stronger. It gets more efficient in what it does. Okay, and when you use a bone, it gets bigger and stronger too. That's why exercise protects you from osteoporosis, right? And when you exercise your brain actually gets smarter. But it gets smarter because of the interconnections that it makes between the cells. So the cells, the number of cells probably doesn't change very much, but the connections between them, right, the network actually changes. So when you take a class like an anatomy class, right, or a physiology class, usually the hardest part of the class is at the beginning, because what is your brain doing? It's screaming. It's going, what's going on here? And then it's making all these different connections all over the place. And usually at the end of the class, you kind of have a feel for what's going on. Because what has happened to your brain? It actually has remodeled itself. So the anatomy of your brain, the microanatomy, the neuroanatomy of your brain actually changes when you take a class that is challenging and stimulating. Whether it's an English class or a language class or a science class, your brain actually changes quite a bit over the course of that class. And of course, that's one of the critiques I have of teaching really fast classes in the summer, like I teach an anatomy class in the summer for 8 weeks. Well, it's really hard to rebuild somebody's brain in just 8 weeks. It takes time for those cells to make new connections, right? So that's just kind of an interesting thing. And so we believe that these astrocytes do release those neurotropins, or you call those eutropins. I have to do a Wikipedia on that and see what the latest is on these kinds of things, okay? And as a matter of fact, these neurotropins, what do they allow your brain to do? They allow your brain to learn. And as you learn, you become more familiar with material and you become, what, less anxious about it as you become more familiar with something. And so we actually think that might be an underlying cause for certain kinds of clinical depression. Because people that are depressed have difficulty learning, they have difficulty appreciating and enjoying life, and we just think that that person's brain just can't remodel fast enough to take in and adjust to all the stresses that everybody gets in their everyday life. Okay. So we do have to learn more about the neuroglia cells. Right, so here is an astrocyte. It can also buffer potassium levels inside and outside the cell. Neurotransmitters are chemicals that are released between cells for communication, and they can regulate these neurotransmitters. They can take them out of the synapse and help regulate communication between cells. And what neurotrophins do is they regulate a process that we call neurogenesis. Neurogenesis is what? The building of new neurons, or actually making new connections between nerves, which is very important for a healthy brain. And you know what? The more that you rebuild your brain and the more you stay active in learning, then the easier it becomes, and the younger your brain will stay longer in your life as well. So probably the best thing to do to have a young brain is pick up a musical instrument sometime in your life and learn how to play new musical instruments, or learn new languages, or study new different kinds of things in science. Okay, astrocytes release transmitters that regulate neuronal activity. Okay, we'll talk about that later in the class. And it also forms that blood-brain barrier, so that only non-toxic materials can leave a capillary into the brain. All right, the membrane potential. All right, let's start with the resting membrane potential, because I think this might even be on the test, right? Resting membrane potential. But before we leave neuroglia and different structural features of neurons, does anybody have a question at all? Any questions? New? Okay. All right, resting membrane potential. Well, what should you think of when you hear resting membrane potential? When you think of a cell, the resting membrane potential makes a cell look like what? Makes it look like a battery. Every cell in your body is acting like a battery. The membrane separates charge. It puts a lot of negative charges on the inside of the cell, and therefore positive charges on the outside, in a relative sense. And the resting membrane potential, I think we could think of it as due primarily to two ions. What two ions would you pick that might establish the resting membrane potential? Sodium and potassium, right? And there's going to be a difference of sodium and potassium across the membrane. One is going to be high on the outside, and the other is going to be high on the inside of the cell. Which ion is high on the outside of the cell in most tissues of your body? We might find a couple exceptions to this rule, but in most cases it is sodium, right? It is sodium, high on the outside, low on the inside. And potassium is then high on the inside, low on the outside. And something that helps maintain that is what? The sodium-potassium ATP pump. And sodium is not very permeable to the cell membrane, so once it's pumped outside the cell, it has a tendency to stay outside the cell. On the other hand, potassium is pretty permeable, and it will actually move from inside to outside of the cell. And as it moves from inside the cell to outside, so if we have a positive ion right here, like potassium leaving, what happens to the overall charge inside the cell? It becomes more negative, right? So that might be one way for you to think about that membrane potential or that membrane voltage. When potassium leaks out, it makes what, the inside of the cell, more negative. So those are just some of the contributing factors. And then, of course, there is a lot of negative charge inside the cell because of, for instance, proteins that are negatively charged, nucleic acids that are negatively charged. They can't leave the cell because they're way too big to get out. So there are all these large anions inside the cell that can't get out. All right, so all cells are excitable. They can discharge their resting membrane potential, right, by rapid changes in permeability to ions. So how can an ion get through a membrane? Can it just diffuse through a membrane? What kind of compound is an ion? Is it hydrophobic or hydrophilic? It's hydrophilic. It loves water because it's polar, because it has charges on it. But remember, the membrane has this big internal thick layer that is what? Hydrophobic. So anything that's hydrophilic can't just diffuse through a membrane, including ions. So in order for an ion to move through the membrane, it's got to have a channel, through it like this. Okay, so that's a channel for ions. And these channels can be closed at some times, and then they can be opened up at other times. So we call that a gated channel, right? If the gate opens up, an ion can go through it. If the gate is closed, an ion can't go through the membrane. And so here is a gate. Here's a gate right here. And on the board, I have a couple examples of gated channels. What are two different kinds of gated channels that we've talked about now? Ligand-gated channels and voltage-gated channels. So here is a gated channel, and it's open, but let's just close it. So now that ion can't go through, for instance, like here's a sodium ion right here. It can't go through because the gate is closed. And if it's a ligand-gated channel, that means that something has to bind to this channel before the gate opens. So, for instance, here might be a little receptor part that can bind something that has a complementary shape to this molecule, to the receptor right here. And when it binds, guess what happens to the gate? It opens up, and sodium can go inside the cell. What happens to the voltage inside the cell as sodium goes in? The positive will do what to these negative charges? It will cancel them out, right? So the voltage changes when this ligand-gated channel binds a ligand. Okay, so that would be an example of a ligand-gated channel. And that causes the voltage. And the voltage is going to go to zero. We call that depolarization. All right, so rapid changes in permeability could be due to ligand-gated channels or even voltage-gated channels that we're going to talk about. And neurons and muscles do this to generate and conduct electrical impulses. So that's just a statement, but we got to put it together. Okay. So the membrane potential can change depending on how these different gated channels are stimulated, either by voltage or by ligands. And we can measure it by placing one electrode inside the cell and one outside the cell. So here we have a really nice oscilloscope that measures voltage. But not, it just doesn't give you a number. It actually gives you a picture of a voltage. That's what an oscilloscope does. So it's like a TV picture of voltage. That's an oscilloscope. Okay. And so here is the display on an oscilloscope, and they used to be just like TV sets. They used to be cathode ray tubes, but now they're probably nice LCD screens, right? Okay, so this is going to give us a plot. So there's always going to be a line moving across the screen. Okay, so that's a time axis. And the vertical axis is just going to be voltage, and we see that this is kind of a small voltage. It's being measured in millivolts. And here's zero. All right, so if anything is ever zero, what can you tell me about its living state? It's dead, that's right. If your temperature is zero, or if your concentration of this or that is zero, if your voltage is zero, you're dead, right? All right, so a living cell is not going to have a zero voltage. We put one electrode. So remember, when we try to measure a battery to see if there's any voltage inside the battery, how many terminals are there? There's always going to be two. Like on your car, there's a positive and a negative terminal. Little batteries you put in a flashlight have two terminals because we always measure a voltage between two points. And so it's a difference in the concentration of electrical charge between two different points. So there's a gradient of electrical charge. One electrode we put on the outside of the cell, and the other electrode we put inside the cell. Right, and that's actually really easy to do, to make a little electrode to place inside the cell. I used to make them all the time. You want to know how you make a little electrode to put inside a cell? Well, you get a piece of glass tubing, just regular glass tubing, and you put it on a Bunsen burner. And what happens to the glass in the Bunsen burner? It heats up, can actually kind of glow a little bit, and it melts, and it kind of sags. And when it melts and sags a little bit, you just pull it. And when you pull it, it gets really, really thin, so thin, and right before it breaks, it's microscopically thin, but it still maintains a tube. So it's still a tube all the way through to the very point of that glass. And in that tube, you can put a salt solution, which can carry electricity. And underneath a microscope, you can see the tip of that electrical, that little glass tube, and you can actually poke it right inside of a cell. And so that's the old-fashioned, that's the poor person's way of making these microscopic pipettes, like if you want to take DNA from a sperm and inject it into an egg, that's how you would make a microscopic pipette to inject DNA into a cell. So it's actually really easy to do that. But you got to be careful, because the tip of that glass rod, how thick is it? It's microscopic, so you can't see where it is. So if you're not careful with it, what are you going to do? You're going to poke yourself and the glass doesn't come out. So you got to be really careful with those pipettes because they're so small. So here is a little glass tube, really tiny diameter glass tube that we can poke inside the cell, no problem, and that can measure the voltage. All right, and the resting cell, a typical resting cell, develops, what, minus 70 millivolts. That means it's minus on the inside compared to the outside, and the magnitude is about 70. So it's going to be, what, below zero by 70. And if we don't do anything to that cell, it's just going to be happy and stay at that voltage. All right, but cells are excitable. We can change that voltage. All right, we can, what we call depolarize it, we can change the membrane voltage from minus 70 and bring it positive up to zero. And when it goes from minus something to zero, what's the state of polarization? Is it getting greater or less as it goes to zero? Okay? It actually goes from a number to zero. That means it's getting less, right? The voltage is actually decreasing. Goes from minus 70 to zero. It's actually decreasing. So we call that depolarization. So cells can depolarize, all right? But also, we can increase the voltage in a cell. And as the voltage increases, we call that repolarization or hyperpolarization, when the membrane potential becomes more negative than the resting membrane potential. All right, and this term repolarization just comes from, if we depolarize it, if we make it go to zero, the cell will repolarize. It will automatically want to go back to what? Minus 70. That's what we call repolarization. So how can we depolarize a cell? And as a matter of fact, I had an example right here, but I'm going to erase it. Okay, so here is that cell. Yeah, we got potassium on the inside, but what's the inside of the cell, of a resting cell? What kind of charge should I put here? Negative. All right, so here's a bunch of negative charges. How could we depolarize this cell? We know that there is, what kind of concentration on the of sodium on the outside? Is it high or low? It's high. So here we have a high concentration of sodium on the outside of the cell, very little on the inside. So just by the concentration gradient, which way does sodium want to go? Does it want to go out or go in? It wants to go in because it's high here and it's low here. There's another force that will move sodium inside the cell, and that's the electrical force. Because what can you tell me about positive charges and negative? They attract, right? So as soon as a channel opens up for sodium, right? So here we have a channel now that's opened up for sodium. What is sodium going to do? It's going to enter the cell. And as these positive charges enter the cell, what happens to the battery nature of the cell? Right now, at the resting, it was minus 70, but as positive charges come in, what happens? Minus 69, minus 68, right? And what do you call it as this number gets smaller and smaller and smaller? That's depolarization, right? So that's one way to depolarize or excite a cell, is by allowing sodium to enter, neutralizing those charges. And we can measure that with just, you know, pretty much any kind of typical oscilloscope, actually. Okay, so membrane potential changes occur by ion flow through membrane channels that can be controlled by ligands or even by voltage. Some channels are normally open. Some are normally closed. Some that are normally open are these potassium leakage channels, right? So if potassium is leaking out of the cell, what's it doing? It's maintaining the negative charge inside of the cell. Closed channels have molecular gates that can be opened. And I guess the first one we're going to talk about are voltage-gated channels. They're opened by depolarization. Voltage-gated potassium channels are closed in the resting cells, and sodium channels are voltage-gated channels. They're closed in resting cells as well. Okay. So here is a model of a voltage-gated ion channel. All right, so here is a channel. You can see the membrane right here. And what's the state of this channel right here? Is it open or closed? It's closed right now. Okay. And I see like a little chain with a ball on it right here. This is what we call an inactivation gate, which I'll talk about in just a second. Well, as the cell is depolarizing, okay, and that is maybe sodium is entering the cell through some kind of ligand-gated channel here. The cell is depolarizing. There is a certain point in time when the voltage across the membrane right here is going to change, and all of a sudden, that's going to change the shape of this protein because the voltage across the membrane has changed. And don't forget that these are proteins, and so their shape, their conformation is sensitive to what? To pH and temperature, salt concentration, and they're even sensitive to to voltage on either side of the protein, because that's going to affect hydrogen bonds and it's going to affect ionic bond structure within this protein molecule, so it's going to change shape. And it's been selected by evolution to change shape at a particular voltage, and it opens up. All right, and so when it opens up, okay, let's say this is a sodium channel. Now sodium can enter the cell, and what's that going to do? That's going to cause even more depolarization. The battery nature of that cell is going to change. Okay, and then after depolarization takes place, then, all right, even though the channel is open, okay, there's this other part of the protein that can clog up the channel, and we call this an inactivation gate. So even though the channel remains open, it is closed because of another mechanism that's taking place. And we need this to describe exactly how a neuron works. All right, so we call this the refractory period. So even though the cell is depolarized and that sodium channel is open, sodium can't get through it because of that inactivation gate. I'm going to have to take a break. I'm hopefully getting over it, yeah, but I caught a cold last week, I guess. Mm-hmm. Okay. That was sort of helpful. But this is really helpful. As long as I don't inhale it. Let's see if there's a warning on the label here. Oh, yeah, use only with adult supervision. Okay. Okay, hopefully somebody knows CPR in here. Yeah, hopefully I don't need it. All right, so that was good. All right, so let's look at an action potential. So in the resting membrane potential, that just means nothing is moving. Nothing is in action. All right, so the state is in, the cell is in just a quiescent state. Nothing's really happening. In an action potential, the cell is being excited, and things are starting to change inside the cell. So something actively is happening. There's some action inside the cell. And that's what an action potential is. It means what? That the voltage is changing across the membrane. Okay, so let's look at this diagram over here on the right-hand side of this slide. So this is a picture of membrane potential, which again is like membrane voltage, and it's going to be measured in millivolts, which is a 1/1000th of a volt, versus time. And the resting membrane potential, right, you maybe would want to label this right here. You're going to call this right here minus 70, what, RMP? And it sort of is on this diagram. You see resting membrane potential right here. It should be at minus 70. And if we don't do anything to that cell, it's happy to stay at that level, at minus 70. But if we give a stimulus to that cell and start it to depolarize, so now what's happening to the membrane voltage? It is changing. It's becoming more positive. As a matter of fact, we call that depolarization, right? When it starts to go up to zero. But in cells, we have voltage-gated channels. And with voltage-gated channels, as soon as the membrane voltage reaches a certain threshold, as signified by this dotted line right here, which looks to be like minus 55 volts or something, that changes a conformation in the protein. Right? And the conformation change is such that it opens up a channel, in particular a sodium channel. So let's see if I can go back one slide. Oh, two slides. So right at this threshold level, when the stimulus reaches threshold, what happens to that membrane protein? It goes from this state to this open state. All right. And so now sodium can do what? This is a sodium channel. Sodium can enter the cell. What happens to the voltage inside the cell when sodium comes in? Okay, it becomes more positive, becomes less negative. So do we see that on this plot? Hopefully so. Yeah. All right, so now that voltage-gated channel is open and sodium rushes in the cell. Why does it rush in the cell? For two reasons. What are the two reasons why sodium can rush inside the cell? Because the concentration gradient is driving it in, as well as the electrical gradient or the potential is pulling it in as well. Okay. So the cell rapidly depolarizes. So number one is just this rapid period of depolarization. And as the membrane depolarizes in this area, more and more voltage-gated channels open. So that kind of is like a positive feedback mechanism for allowing sodium to enter the cell. And that's why there's such a rapid increase in a rapid change in the membrane potential or depolarization. Okay, but then it stops. We get to the peak of the action potential right here. Why does it stop? Why does that sodium stop entering the cell? Because at this point in time, what happens is this inactivation gate closes and it prevents any further entry of sodium into the cell. Right? And if sodium can't enter the cell, what happens to depolarization? It stops. Right? So when sodium can't get into the cell cannot become more positive after that point in time. And so it stops becoming more positive right when that inactivation gate closes, right here. So closing of this inactivation gate is where? Right here at the peak of this action potential. And it stays closed for a while. Okay, now right at about this time, something else happens. There is another voltage-gated channel that opens up that is specific to potassium. Okay, so where do we have a high concentration of potassium? Inside the cell? Right here, where is low? Outside? There's low potassium outside. But now right there, what can you tell me? What's the voltage there? Is it positive or negative now inside the cell? It's positive, right? The polarity has changed. All right, so now we have positive charges inside the cell compared to the outside, which is negative. So now, what about potassium? What does it want to do? It wants to go from high to low, from inside to outside by a concentration, but it also wants to leave the cell because the electrical charge is going to pull it out. All right, so now potassium rapidly leaves the cell because these potassium channels are opened up. And as a positive charge leaves the inside of the cell, what happens to the charge of the cell? It becomes less positive, or you could say negative. So the cell repolarizes when potassium leaves the cell, right here. And that is signified by this descending limb of the action potential. And when it passes this threshold voltage here again, those inactivation gates open up once again. The sodium voltage channels reset themselves. And there's so much potassium that leaves the cell that it actually gets more negative than the resting case. And we call this just an overshoot right here. We call this a relative refractory period. All right, so this is the action potential. An action potential is a change in the battery nature of the cell due to voltage-gated channels. And it has a number of important features, but basically it has two main phases. What are the two main phases of an action potential? It is, what is that phase called? That is depolarization, and then there is repolarization, and we kind of went over the mechanism of why that happens. So what's the molecular basis of depolarization? Just a classical understanding of depolarization is what ion is moving and in what direction is it moving? It is sodium moving inside the cell. And the second phase is, okay, is potassium leaving the cell, and we call that repolarization. Yeah, sorry about that. Repolarization. And this little overshoot right here of repolarization, we call that hyperpolarization. And that's the relative refractory period of this nerve. Okay, so let's see if I can understand these diagrams over here. So depolarization stimulus will affect both the sodium and potassium voltage-gated channels, but one of these channels is faster. Which one is faster? They're triggered at about the same point, but one is faster. It is the? Okay, yeah, and which channel is responsible for depolarization? Which channel is responsible for depolarization? It is the sodium channels. So the sodium voltage-gated channels are faster. So these are the fast ones up over here. These are the slow ones down over here. So it's just the nature of how fast that protein changes conformation. Okay. There's something else that I'll mention right now. And that is, you'll see a lot in physiology, if something has a very fast onset of action, its duration is very short. And that's very true. That's true for instance, barbiturates. Right? If somebody is given a fast-acting barbiturate, they'll be under the influence of that barbiturate in just a matter of seconds, but their body will be under the influence for a very short period of time. It will be cleared from their body. It will be metabolized very quickly. All right, but if there's a drug that has a very slow onset of action, then their body will retain it and it will have a longer duration. All right, that's just something that's almost ubiquitous in nature. If something is fast, its duration is, or if its onset is fast, its duration is very short. If its onset is very long in coming, then the duration is long as well. So the same thing for these channels. The fastest one is the sodium channel. But how long does it stay open for? Just a short period of time, and then it closes. The slow one is the potassium channel, but look how long it stays open for. It even causes hyperpolarization of the membrane because it stays open for a long period of time. Okay, so those are some of the things that you should know about these two different gated channels. So depolarization stimulus is going to cause the opening of both the sodium and potassium gates, but the ones that open first are the sodium, okay, because they're faster, right? And when they open up, it allows sodium to enter the cell, which what causes depolarization, which causes more sodium gates to open because they're voltage gated, which allows more sodium to enter, which opens more sodium gates. So that's what we call what? Positive feedback. That causes a rapid depolarization, and then right at then the inactivation gate closes right at about 30 millivolts right here, the inactivation gate, so the sodium channel closes, and at about the same time the potassium channel opens up, and that causes repolarization and stays open for a relatively long period of time that produces this hyperpolarized area of the cell. Okay, so this is just one example of an action potential at one location on a cell. Now, where on a neuron do we have these voltage-gated channels? Okay, yeah, we got them on a membrane. So what part of a nerve cell is that? That is the soma, or the cell body. And these are the dendrites, and this is the axon. Okay? So it's this region of a neuron here that has the voltage-gated channels. Only in this region. Not in this region right here. And because this is where the voltage-gated channels are, this is the sending part of the neuron. Not particularly sensitive to a stimulus. Okay. But this part of the neuron over here has the ligand-gated channels. So this is the receiving part. Alright, so here we have voltage-gated channels, over here ligand-gated channels. So we said that in order to stimulate these voltage-gated channels, we needed what? A stimulus to do that, right? And that stimulus was, how would you characterize that stimulus? Was that a depolarizing stimulus or a hyperpolarizing stimulus? It's depolarizing, right? To get that, to get the membrane voltage up to threshold, okay? Well, these channels over here don't operate by voltage, right? In order for these channels to open up, they have to bind something. What do we call a channel that binds? We'll make it look like that. Okay? What has to bind here to open that channel up? Okay? A ligand of some kind. Right? And an example of a ligand might be a neurotransmitter binding right here, and when this gate opens up, sodium can enter the cell. That changes the voltage of this cell, and that voltage then will sweep over to this region, and if it's sufficient enough to reach threshold, when it gets to this part of the neuron, what's it going to affect? These voltage-gated channels. So the electrical signal is a lot different on the receiving end of the cell compared to the sending end of the cell, because receiving end has the ligand voltage channels, and the sending part has, oh no, sorry, that was just like nonsense. The receiving part of the neuron has ligand-gated channels, okay, and the sending part of the neuron has these voltage-gated channels. So on this slide right here, the voltage-gated channel produces what kind of potential? Action potential. Okay, so an action potential is found on the sending part of the neuron because it has voltage-gated channels. These electrical disturbances over here on the receiving end are not called action potentials. So action potentials are only on part of the neuron, not the complete neuron. These potentials over here that are produced by ligand-gated channels are what we call graded potentials. Graded potentials. The interesting thing about, we're almost done. Oh, we are done. Okay. The interesting thing about a voltage, an action potential, is that they move from one end of the axon to the other without changing. So we call that without decrement. They don't change. So even if this axon was a million miles long, the action potential on one side of the axon would be exactly the same as the other end. All right, so I'll talk about more of that later next time. Well, a week from today anyway, after your next test. I'm so glad I didn't need CPR.